So it's a pleasure today to have Flavio Baccari as our speaker. And he will talk about self-testing Bell inequalities from the stabilizer formalism and their applications. Flavio, the stage is yours. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Flaminio, for the kind introduction. I'm very happy to be here talking about this work. Can you still hear me? I sort of lost the audio track. I'm just wondering if...
Yes, we hear you.
Yes. Okay, fantastic, sorry. Great. So as I was saying before, I will be talking about some work it was mostly initiating during my time in at ICFO in Barcelona, with several people that were also there at some point and of course are now scattered a bit all around Europe. And the main framework of the work is self-testing. So I'll start by giving you a quick introduction to the framework. So self-testing falls into this class of device-independent protocols, which are also related to this Bell scenario formalism. So what is a Bell scenario? A Bell scenario is generally a scenario in which we are assuming that we are working with particles that are separated from each other in some way, and we're assuming we can address them separately and in a way that doesn't disturb the other in the process. The others. What we say is usually we are performing local measurements on those particles. And then this can be modeled quite in an abstract way by assuming that each particle is put in a box. And we are actually interacting with this box by pressing some inputs. So choosing some values for this xi to xn variables. Those can be measurement choices generally. So for instance, we could have dichotomic measurement choices and on each particle, choosing whether xi 0 or 1 might be the equivalent of choosing whether to measure Pauli x or Pauli y. And then upon pressing this input, we'll get an output, we can record it. And this would be representing the measurement outcomes of those measurements, a1 to an. And so the quantity we are looking at is basically this collection of probability distributions, conditional probability distributions, P of the measurement different measurement outcomes given the measurement choices we made. Which of course, if you are talking about quantum state and measurements will basically be computed by the Born rule. But the main motivation behind device independent protocols is that actually what we do is to make no assumption on the content of those boxes. We just treat them as something containing possibly an object. We don't really know if it's actually behaving quantumly or not. We just assume that there is no influence from one box to the other during the experiment. And by looking at those collection of classical numbers, basically the output we can collect from the experiment, we want to infer properties of the underlying state and measurements. If any, of course, this will depend on the kind of correlation we observe. And in particular, fundamental concept in this scenario is that of local correlations. Those are all the kind of correlations you can achieve by classical means. It's the correlation equivalent of separable states. So as for separable states, we are assuming basically that there is some sort of shared randomness. So this lambda that is distributed to the boxes according to some possibly pre-designed strategy. And then all the correlations that we can observe are basically mediated by this shared randomness, because apart from that, the output of the local measurement is chosen only according to the local input. And also according to this lambda, this shared randomness. And an essential ingredient for a device-independent protocol is to actually observe the opposite of local correlations. So to be able to show that the measurement, the correlations you observe cannot actually be described by any local model. And this is, in the context of device-independent protocols, is treated as a resource. There is no way to certify some quantum property of the underlying state of measurements if one doesn't observe no local correlations. And then it's also convenient to look at this from a geometrical perspective. The way to do it, the standard way to do it, is to arrange all the probabilities in this collection of conditional probabilities into a vector. So listing all these numbers will make a very long vector, so a point in a very high dimensional space generally. And then in this high dimensional space, we can define these two convex objects, two convex sets. One is the set of local correlations. So all the points you would get by choosing a local model, and all the quantum correlations, which are all the points you can get by performing local measurements on quantum states in any dimension. So it doesn't have to be qubits. It can be in any local states in any local dimension. And something I will be using quite a lot next will be Bell inequalities. So in this geometrical picture, Bell inequalities are hyperplanes separating the local set from the outside. Equivalently, they are linear inequalities in the probabilities that are satisfied by any point inside the local set. So by any local probability distributions, meaning that their violation serves as a direct certification of non-locality. So the moment we see the violation of a Bell inequality, we directly infer that the probability distribution couldn't be local, so it's non-local. So in this sense, violating a Bell inequality is always a necessary ingredient for a device-independent protocol. So now, talking about the specific device-independent protocol I will be focusing from now on, we'll be talking about self-testing of states, of quantum states. So this is one of the most informative forms of device-independent protocols, because starting from some properties of the probability distribution, we want to infer the form of the state that was measured as if some properties of those correlations acted as a fingerprint for the state. This is generally not possible it's generally not possible to determine the state precisely, but only up to some undetectable symmetries. In this context, those symmetries are local isometries. And the reason for that is that basically applying local isometries to the state will lead to another state which can produce the same kind of correlation. So by just looking at the correlations, we wouldn't be able to distinguish whether we're measuring the state or any other local isometry equivalent state. So this means that a formal way of stating self-testing is basically showing that the state phi that is producing the correlations we observe is local isometry equivalent to the state we want to self-test, tensors are uncorrelated degrees of freedom. So here you see that the local isometry is basically defined as adding some ancillary systems and performing local unitaries on one particle of the state and one of the ancillary systems. Okay. So very quickly, just an example to make things a bit more concrete. This is probably the most well-known self-testing example. It's also the most well-known Bell inequality, which is CHSH. So it's a Bell inequality for a scenario with two measurements per party and two parties, Alice and Bob. So we have A0, A1, B0, B1. And it was shown that the maximal quantum violation can be achieved with any state and measurement is 2√2. And actually it's possible to show that if we observe this number, let's say if we see correlations producing this number, then we can show that the state producing them is local isometry equivalent to the maximal entangled state of 2 qubits. Okay. So let me focus on a hard challenge in the context of cell testing. And to introduce it, I will start with a sort of practical mitigation. The practical mitigation comes from something that is getting more and more common nowadays, which is the possibility of accessing some quantum device, maybe in the cloud or just by buying it from a producer, in a way that in principle, we know what it's supposed to do. So we can look at somehow its instruction manual. And we know that if we perform some operations, if we ask it to perform some operations, we should get the state psi. But of course, if we want to certify that this is exactly the state that was produced by the system, the only thing we can do is interact with the system by performing measurements and try to infer that everything was working correctly from the measurements we saw. So in some sense, I would say self-testing in many practical scenarios stars would make sense motivated starting from a state. So basically, it would make sense to define a problem which is given a state we would like to certify. So a state we would like to make sure that we have been producing in the lab. How do we actually tailor a self-testing scheme to this state? And this, of course, requires choosing a suitable set of local measurements, because we need to find a good guess for the measurements and leading to some correlations that are actually good as a fingerprint for this state. And a very important necessary condition for this to work is actually for the correlations we observe to be extremal in the quantum set, so to be at the boundary of this set, which is actually equivalent to for them to be by maximally violating a Bell inequality. So actually, from now on, I will be focusing on this kind of problem. So if you fix a state, how does one actually find a Bell inequality, tailor it in a way that is maximally violated by this state? And this is potentially more useful for practical implementations. And at the moment, like at the stage where self-testing is now, it's actually also the best way to find robustness bounds for errors for self-testing. And the problem is that this is like tailoring a Bell inequality to a state is generally a very hard challenge. Also, and this works also for self-testing. The reason being that many of the self-testing results and techniques are usually start from the Bell inequality itself. So they start with a well-known Bell inequality and then knowing which is the state maximally violating it, try to prove self-testing from there. And going the other way around, of course, it's much less trivial. And since it's very hard, I will not show you the solution to the problem. I will show you some steps we did to solve it for a very specific class of states, which is graph states. So why graph states specifically? The main reason is that graph states are very easily defined in terms of a set of stabilizing operators. So basically, for any graph state of n particles associated to a connectivity graph, one can find a collection of n operators that are commuting with each other, such that the graph state is the unique eigenstate with eigenvalue one of those operators. And sometimes this is also referred to the property of being stabilized by all those operators. And for the specific case of graph states, those stabilizing operators are also quite simple because they're just tensor product of Pauli X and Z. And they are defined as the Pauli X on the particle tensor, the Pauli Z on the neighbors. So for instance, if one takes this ring, basically it would be S1 would be X on particle one and Z on two and N and so on until the last one. So the state associated to this graph, the graph state associated to this graph is the only eigenstate of eigenvalue one of all of them. And so what we found in this project we're working on is basically a strategy that starts from the stabilizing operator and from them, gives a step-by-step procedure to define a self-testing Bell inequality. So a Bell inequality maximally violated by the associated graph state and whose maximal violation directly self-tests the graph state. So the way it works is the following. The first step for this procedure is to define some sort of device-independent equivalent of the Pauli measurements. So one defines operators in terms now of unknown measurement operators. So the notation here means that the subscript is the measurement choice. So M0 and M1 would be two different possible measurement choice for particle I, which is indicated by the subscript in parentheses, on parentheses. Okay, and the substitution works in a way that basically in most of the particles, the substitution is trivial. So M0 and M1 are just associated to X and Z. And for particle one, X1 and Z1, this sort of device-independent version of the Pauli operators are a linear combination of two measurement operators. And then step two is to define stabilizing some sort of device in the independent equivalent of the stabilizing operator as taking the form of the original ones and expressing them in terms of those unknown measurements. And then the Bell inequality is basically a suitably chosen linear combination of the expectation values of those operators. Okay, so now, just to see an example, this would be how it works for this ring graph state. You see that basically the only stabilizers in which the substitution is not trivial are those involving particle one. So here we have linear combination of the measurement operators for particle one. And then this is just to show how the inequality would look like. There is this two here appearing because of the connectivity of the first particle, which is connected to two different particles. Yes. Okay. So just to give an intuition why this form of the inequality would actually lead to the maximal violation achieved by the graph state, the idea is to sort of define the inverse, the substitution. So if one makes the measurement choice of that leads exactly to the Pauli X and Z, so one chooses measurements in a way that the M0 plus M1 for particle one divided by square root of two gives Pauli X1 and so on for all the others, then of course the Bell inequality, measuring the Bell inequality with those measurement choices amounts to measuring the stabilizing operators, the Pauli stabilizing operators. And so then in such a case, of course, the best one can do is to measure on the graph state. So to give the value one on all the stabilizing operators and get to this kind of value for the quantum violation. Of course, this is not the end of the story because I at the moment, I didn't show you that this is the maximal quantum violation. So the maximal value one can achieve with any measurement choice in any quantum state. And a very convenient way of doing so is to use a so-called sum of squares. So by taking the Bell operator, so the operator associated to the Bell inequality, one can define this kind of shifted Bell operator. So the beta Q identity minus the Bell operator. And if one proves that this operator is a sum of squares of operators, then this would be a positive semi-definite operator, directly implying that the expectation value of this, of any state on this operator would be smaller or equal than the maximal quantum violation. So this would be a way of proving that this beta Q value is not, cannot be exceeded by any other state, basically. And the convenient feature of our strategy is that basically the sum of squares can be directly expressed again in terms of this stabilizing operators, the sort of, again, I'm calling them device independent stabilizing operators. And the other convenient feature is that, so now if one actually observes the quantum violation, so if any state achieving beta Q basically saturates this inequality, so it gives you zero exactly, meaning implying directly that the state has to have expectation value zero on all the terms in this square, which has a very simple form and basically can be rewritten in this way. So if a state achieves the maximal quantum violation, then the state satisfies some sort of equivalent of the stabilizing condition in terms of this S tilde operators. And this is exactly the basically the main feature that leads to self-testing, because basically one can, by the way we chose the form of those operators, those one can show that basically those conditions are equivalent, well, allow to show that this X tilde and Z tilde behave, somehow satisfy properties that are typical of the Pauli X and Z, so they anti-commute with each other and they square to identity, which then can be, basically those properties can be used to show that there is a local isometry mapping them to the Pauli X and Z, meaning that there is a local isometry mapping the state to a state that is stabilized by the Pauli stabilizing operators, which is exactly the graph state by definition. So this is basically the logical reasoning for self-testing. The self-testing comes from the fact that the Bell inequality has a sum of squares written in a way that the maximum violation implies those kind of device independent stabilizing condition, which are written in a way that imply this sort of Pauli behavior for the operators, which directly imply a local isometry to a qubit subspace, a qubit space basically, and the standard stabilizing condition. Okay, just to show you an example, and also to say that this recovers the CHSH example basically, because to maximally entangle two qubit state is also a graph state. It's basically the simplest one for two particles. And then in this scenario, basically one would make the substitution for particle one. So for A, again, with this linear combination, for B, just the trivial substitution, and the two stabilizing operators are X on A, Z on B, and X on B, Z on A. And then if one writes the Bell inequality, as I was saying before, for this case, one recovers exactly CHSH. So somehow this kind of strategy, it can be seen as a sort of generalization of the CHSH, construction of the CHSH inequality to all other graph states. And it's also a generalization of the self-testing scheme for CHSH to the case of all the graph states. Okay. So yes, maybe, I don't know, some of you might wonder, okay, but is this, I don't know, what is new in this context? Because it's true that we are not the first at finding Bell inequalities that are maximally violated by graph states. There are other constructions. And also we are not the first at proving self-testing for graph states. But somehow I would argue that there is a quite some convenient features in this approach. And one of the reasons is basically the approach is combining self-testing and Bell inequality violation in the sense that the previous self-testing scheme was not using the maximum violation of Bell inequality. So it was not associating a Bell inequality to the self-testing scheme. And on the other hand, the Bell inequalities that are known, that are maximally violated by graph states, are not associated to a self-testing statement. So it's not clear how to self-test, or if it's possible to self-test graph states from the maximum violation of those other Bell inequalities. And also other convenient features that we get somehow for free is that the Bell inequalities we construct are actually more efficiently measurable in principle because they are composed on only linearly many expectation values, as opposed to exponentially many for other constructions. And they're also potentially robust to errors. This is, we just got numerical evidence for this, actually showing robustness to errors in analytica is quite hard, but I don't know, maybe at some point it would be possible, and I'm not sure. And then, okay, actually what I want to talk about next is some sort of bonus feature of this scheme, which is, hopefully it was clear by what I was saying before, which is that we have a strategy. One can outline of a specific strategy starting from stabilizing operators and leading to a Bell inequality in a self-testing scheme. So of course, ideally, one could say, okay, why not exporting this strategy to other states defined by adding other stabilizing operators? This has to be, okay, it cannot be what is usually called stabilizer states, because those are actually unitarily equivalent to graph states. So actually, since self-testing can be done only up to local isometries, in some sense, the self-testing of graph states directly implies the self-testing of any stabilizer states. But of course, one could consider more complex scenarios like stabilizing operators that are made of non-Pauli operators or non-local stabilizing operators. But what I will focus on next is actually a different option, which is exporting this strategy to define self-testing in some other scenarios, where basically we're not talking about a single state anymore, but we're talking about a whole subspace. So just to motivate this kind of scenario, let me start with something that is a common belief in the self-testing community usually, which is that mixed states cannot be self-tested. And I'll try to motivate this by geometrical reasoning. The main idea is that a mixed state is a convex combination of pure state, meaning that if we measure this state, what we would get is a convex combination of points, basically the ones coming from the pure state. And then geometrically, this looks, in general, it would look like this. So the PI points would be the extremals, and we would be somewhere here in the middle of the line. So we wouldn't be extremal. And I was telling you that extremality is basically a necessary ingredient for self-testing. And to motivate it a bit more, one way of arguing why extremality is necessary for self-testing is basically that if I'm not extremal, I could be seeing the point I get either as the one resulting from the state I'm measuring or resulting from a state that is actually leading to some point at the boundary and then some white noise or noise generally that is basically taking the state, but the correlations away from the bound, from the border. And somehow those two scenarios, those two states already generally have two states that are not local isometric equivalent. So there is no unique association from a non-extremal point to the to a single state, basically. So the, of course, this we don't want to claim that this is not true. What I will show you next is actually an example in which the solution to this problem is that there is scenarios in which the whole line defined by this convex combination is extremal on the quantum set. So the whole line is maximally violating a single Bell inequality. And there would be there is a possibility to define a notion of self-testing, basically, even for mixed states leading to those correlations. So where do we find examples of this kind? Well, first of all, we have to find suitable subspaces. So subspaces that are containing only entangled states, because otherwise some states inside the subspace would be wouldn't be violating a Bell inequality. And so a good place to find them is quantum error correction codes that are codes that are usually used to encode logical qubits into entangled quantum state of physical qubits. And the other reason why we focus on error correction codes is comes from what I was telling you before. So meaning that we can make use of the stabilizing formalism. So there is quantum error correction codes that are defined again in terms of stabilizing operators. The only difference here is that now, if one wants to define a subspace, one has to use fewer stabilizing operators. So for instance, if one uses n minus k stabilizing operators for an n particle state, if those stabilizing operators are independent, so they cannot be written one as product of the others, then the subspace of states stabilized by all the operators would be of dimension 2 to the k. And that's also why they can be used to encode logical qubits, basically. So let me show you an example, which is the 5-qubit code. So the 5-qubit code is defined by 4 stabilizing operators for a 5-particle state, meaning that there is 2 orthogonal states that are stabilized by those operators that are usually used to encode a logical qubit. But from now on, we can forget by we can forget this feature, basically, and basically apply the same strategy I was telling you before, just moving from the stabilizing operators to the Bell inequality, basically. So one can basically make the substitution I was showing you before. So defining this sort of device independent operators, get a Bell inequality from those 4 operators, and then get the sum of squares and prove basically that there is a maximal violation for this Bell inequality, which is achieved by any state in the subspace stabilized by those 4 operators. So basically any state belonging to this 5-qubit code subspace. And this is exactly an example. So we could check that this was an example of the one I was showing you before. So basically of this line being extremal on the quantum set, the extremal point somehow corresponding to the correlations arising from the logical 0 and 1, but any other point in the line would be still maximally violating the Bell inequality, but it would be achieved by maybe a superposition of the two states or a mixed state of a mixture of the two. Okay, so how do we define self-testing in such a scenario? Of course, now we have many states that are associated to the same violation of the Bell inequality. So one has to change the definition of self-testing. It cannot be that there is a local isometry mapping the state to producing the observed correlations to a single state. And so what we basically introduce is a notion of, weak notion of self-testing, in which, so now what we can say is that basically there is a local isometry from the state producing the correlations to something that can be a superposition of the logical 0 and 1, possibly correlated to the additional degrees of freedom. So that's basically the reason why I say that the self-testing here is somehow weaker, because we lose the uncorrelations to the additional degrees of freedom. So there might be additional degrees of freedom that we are not measuring in the experiment that are correlated to the state, but they are correlated in a very limited way. So they can be correlated only with the information of where exactly in the subspace the state is, basically. And then the other modification is this additional symmetry imposed by this value of P, basically the value of the superposition between the logical zero and one, which is something we are completely insensitive to. That's why I'm calling it an additional symmetry, because basically it's again something that if we change the value of P, we wouldn't see any difference in the violation of the Bell inequality. And then this includes this statement includes mixed states, because for instance, you can trace out the J degrees of freedom and you will get a mixture of the logical zero and one. So this kind of self-testing statement includes the option of self-testing mixed state, of course, in a weaker way and with some additional assumption, basically. Okay, so the last thing I want to mention is the fact that then, apart from the 5-qubit code, we looked also at this Tori code, which is an error correction code that is defined on a lattice, basically. So one can basically define stabilizing operators as plaquette and vertex operators on this lattice, again, composed only of Z and X operators. And this allows to define subspace encoding two logical qubits for any number of, so for a lattice of any number of particles. So we could basically take those kind of operators and generalize this self-testing of subspaces to a scenario in which now, instead of having two orthogonal states, we have four orthogonal states spanning the subspace. And also to show somehow that at least as a, let's say, example, that there is examples that of self-testing of subspaces for any number of particles. So for Bell scenarios of composed of any number of particles. And the same goes for these flat structures at the boundary of the quantum set I was telling you about. So because they, again, all the points maximally violating the inequality we get from the toric code for any number of particles would define a flat structure. So some higher dimensional flat space at the boundary of the quantum set. Okay, so very short outlook. There's many open questions. I didn't discuss during the talk, but mostly there's many open questions that we didn't address yet. The first one is robustness to noise. I was telling you that we have indications that those Bell inequalities are robust to noise, meaning that, so the way robustness is usually defined is, suppose one doesn't see the maximum violation, but something like the maximum violation minus epsilon, then can actually, there is possibilities to bound the fidelity between the observed state and the one wants to self-test as a function of epsilon. Doing this analytically is very hard. So at the moment we just got indications that this fidelity decreases linearly with the observed violation, which is potentially nice. And then the other open questions is applying this same formalism to other stabilizers, so to other states, where maybe, I guess the first non-trivial example would be hypergraph states. We tried a little bit, but we didn't manage. It's not clear if we have to somehow generalize or modify the strategy in some way to account for no local stabilizing operators. And then the last one here, it's very vague. I mean, it's mostly a speculative questions, and which is since there is a clear connection between quantum error correction codes and fault-tolerant quantum computation, what is the use of the self-testing of a quantum error correction subspace? Is that even useful for some sort of device independent certification of some error correction schemes or anything of this kind? I find it interesting, but at the moment we don't really have many ideas how to do that. Okay. So with this, I'll thank you for your attention and also thank all my collaborators, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
And let's thank Flavio. So are there questions?
Can I ask a question? So mm-hmm. is it, if you have a given a given Bell inequality, which is maximally mm-hmm. violated by a state, then is there a kind of uniqueness in the sense that the only states which maximally violate that Bell inequality are the ones that are related by this equivalence class that you discussed? Is that right?
I'm not sure if this applies like in generally, but there is many cases in which that's true. I think it's not obvious that maximally violating a single Bell inequality is necessarily so it's a necessary condition for self-testing, but it's not sufficient. So there might be cases in which that's not enough. I don't know if this is this answers your questions or.
Yeah, I'm just curious as to what extent the Bell inequality itself encodes that equivalence class.
Yeah, that's not clear. I mean, there is cases like CHSH has this property and all the ones I was showing you. So the the violation, so the single number is enough to make a self-testing statement. But generally, I think it's not the case.
Okay. And one could also imagine sort of a problem where because your problem was with respect to sort of systems that are distributed in space, so to speak, and so you have this natural equivalence class. But mm-hmm. presumably one could imagine sort of different equivalence classes that were motivated by some different physical setup.
Mm-hmm.
And then you might try to associate an inequality with that. So perhaps one could consider a more general set of problems in that context.
I guess, yes. So I think I'm aware of self-testing schemes for instance, prepare and measure scenarios. Mm-hmm. Now it's sort of, there is some examples there. I guess there is also some sort of self-testing statement, at least for some cases, it was also found for contextuality scenarios. Mm-hmm. Now I'm not sure if there is any other at the moment, but yeah, I guess, why not? I mean, yeah.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Are there other questions? Yes, Rob.
Yeah, I just wanted to try to understand better the new definition of self-testing you were proposing.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe if you could go back to that slide.
Yes, where is it? Here.
And maybe before you explain, I guess mm-hmm. I'm trying to situate it relative to a resource theoretic definition of self-testing. So there was a group from PI who put out a paper in April mm-hmm. where we were talking about sort of doing entanglement theory with local operations and shared randomness. And we had a section there on self-testing where we just noted that you can self-test mixed states because any bipartite pure entangled state also has some mixed states in its LOSR equivalence class. So mm-hmm. so that was one sense in which you could self-test a mixed state.
I see.
Mm-hmm. With the idea being that we're using a notion of self-testing, which is based on sort of extraction. So, you know, you can self-test for psi if whatever state can be used to generate the correlations you saw could also mm-hmm. be converted into psi by LOSR. So that was the kind of definition of self-testing we were working with. So I'm kind of trying to figure out whether your definition here mm-hmm. matches that or not. It feels like not, because psi naught and psi one are not LOSR interconvertible.
Uh-huh.
Maybe I'll let you answer my question, try to clarify for me but I'm just telling you where I'm coming from, trying to fit this in with my understanding of the extraction notion of self-testing. Anyhow, go ahead.
I'm not sure I know how to answer this question properly, because I'm also still quite confused by this definition. I mean, it sort of works, but I don't know the way at the moment I'm interpreting it is somehow that it's not like those single states couldn't be self-tested, but somehow it's more a property of the fact that we are using partial information about the correlations that we are observing, in the sense that it's mostly the fact that somehow one could say that the Bell inequalities we are using have this property of only allowing for weak self-testing. Maybe by the way they are designed, like there are Bell inequalities that are, for instance, those, like for the case of the toric code, they are so we have highly like many particle states, but actually the Bell inequality is using only a few body correlations. And for instance, if one used another Bell inequality, it would be, for instance, enough to add just one term to the Bell inequality to get something that is self-testing the single state, like the logical zero or logical one. So I don't know, I guess in some sense, it's mostly, yeah, I don't know. I see it mostly as a property of the Bell inequality and not of the states in the subspace. I don't know if this is sort of an answer, but.
So let me see if I've understood. You're saying that this is a notion of self-testing that's sort of native to subspaces, not to states. So, you know, if you violate this kind of Bell inequality, there's no single state which you can claim has been self-tested in the sense that you couldn't extract that single state from the resource. All you can do is say it's some state in this subspace or the convex hull of this subspace.
Right.
So that's the sense in which is a weaker notion of self-testing, because it picks out a subspace rather than a one-dimensional subspace.
Right. Yes. But yeah, I would say it's mostly, I mean, I would see it as a property of the inequality we are using, in the sense that, of course, if one used the whole information about the correlations extracted from the state in subspace, there might be a possibility of self-testing the single state. It's mostly the fact that we are using a single number out of those correlations, which is the maximum violation of the Bell inequality we are looking at, which allows only for this sort of weak association. So we cannot associate it to a single state, rather to a whole subspace.
I see. Okay, well, so in the language that of this resource theoretic approach, I would say that what you've got here is something where you have a self-testing protocol for an LOSR equivalence class. What I'm thinking is that everything in this subspace is interconvertible by local operations and shared randomness.
I guess,
Oh, maybe that's not quite right. Okay, sorry. I thought I knew how to characterize it, but I don't. So I'll think about it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for the question.
Do we have more questions?
So I want to just make sure I'm understanding at a high level what you're doing here. In the beginning, you had a slide which I think I disagreed with, but I think then you sort of clarified it. you were saying. So you said that a state is extremal on the quantum set. If and only if this point maximally violates the Bell inequality, and that's clearly not true, because we have examples of these kind of flat boundaries where you can maximally violate a Bell inequality, and there are lots of points in the space of quantum correlations which are not extremal which do that. So if you're talking about a Bell inequality which picks out a flat boundary, then it's no longer the case that maximal violation of the Bell inequality gives an implication of extremality. And on that note, we can distinguish I think three kinds of boundary points. There's general boundary points, which are associated with at least one Bell inequality, which they maximally violate. There are extremal points, which are sort of special cases. And then you can get really lucky, and I think this is what you were assuming, which are exposed points. An exposed point is one which is the unique point which achieves the maximum violation of a Bell inequality. So if you have a Bell inequality which only one point in the space of quantum correlations achieves the maximum violation, then that's when the Bell inequality can tell you extremality. But if the Bell inequality is not associated with a single point. So to this point, we also have lots of Bell inequalities which don't admit any kind of quantum violation, but which still have sort of non-local points which saturate the Bell inequality. So you can have So like Lucy and Hardy's here, there's the Hardy box is a demonstration of quantum non-locality. And if you look first of a Bell inequality, which identifies that, you can't, because it the only Bell inequalities associated with that are also saturated by local correlations, even though they're also saturated by non-local correlations. And then I think what you did is you said this really clean notion of what are the kind of Bell inequalities that you want. You want Bell inequalities where it doesn't matter if they pick out a flat space or a single space, it's just that they're not saturated by any local points. And this is what you're talking about, like equalizers, which only include entangled states. So if you find these boundaries, so long as the boundary is flat and is not local saturated, then you can use it to self-test. And you can say, you know, it has to be some thing which is related to that boundary. And then the stabilizer argument, where you sort of say, like, okay, what's nice about Toro codes and other things is that they identify subspaces of only entangled states, and therefore your construction identifies these sort of guaranteed regions which are not going to have any local correlations, saturating the Bell inequality, right? So I really like this. So I was kind of coming at it from the perspective of, like, what can we say about when the quantum space is flat? Like, just pictorially, when is the space of quantum correlations have flat boundaries? And a lot of the examples that are known are instances where we can find, like, a flat boundary of the quantum set, but it has a local point. And so you're given a construction which finds many, many flat parts of the quantum set. And I think with the error correction, you always have, like, these logical qubits, and so you could say, like, it's a one-dimensional flat region, and with the Toro codes, it's you know, a higher dimensional flat region, but they're all of these forms which don't include any local states. Once you have that sort of high-level concept, why can't you immediately generalize to hypergraph stabilizers and say, like, you know, for any set of stabilizers which guarantee that I'm in some sort of subspace which is only includes these non-local states, why can't you
do it? Well, the reason is mostly technical. Like, it's basically, if you blindly apply the strategy I was telling you, you get with a, like, something doesn't work in the process. Like, you get a Bell inequality that is not maximally, or I think which the local bound is equal to the quantum bound, or now I don't remember, maybe it was the sum of squares that didn't work.
The screen.
I'll share again. I'll show you which part is breaking down for these hypergraph states. Basically, let's see. Here, I think, so the thing is, okay, so you have basically, actually, okay, there is a first step, which is now you have stabilizing operators that are non-local, so they're not tensor products of local operators. Of course, you can express them in terms of Pauli measurements, but it will be a linear combination of them. And that's where, for some reason, things break down, because the moment you make this substitution, the one, where is it? Here, this X and Z, sort of, device independent X and Z, then you carry on all the steps and you get to a Bell inequality that, if I remember well, it's not even, like, violated. And then at the moment, I don't know, I guess there might be ways of fixing this, because maybe we're looking at the strategy in the wrong way. Maybe this is not the right starting point. So I think something we were looking at some point was if whether the right starting point is actually to start from this sum of squares. So maybe you want a Bell inequality whose maximal violation implies the stabilizing conditions. And maybe there is a better way of writing it for a hypergraph state. So for no local stabilizing operators. But this, for the moment, we didn't find it.
That's quite terrifying. Yeah, like, it has to be, if you're going to just take the operators and make a Bell inequality out of them in a obvious way, they need to be local operators.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The tensor product, and so the graph states have that. Okay.
Yeah, but thanks for the clarification. It's true. I was sure I made this mistake. I remember this distinction between extremal and exposed, and I clearly used the wrong one. It should be exposed, yes, for what I'm saying.
Okay, are there more questions? Okay, if not, let's thank our speaker again.
Thank you.